Hackers, DJ Micro Brew with 39 minutes of file checking, hacking, deleting, yupper cut and pasting, the corporate media. But first, these red lines. FTCM equals FSCK, the corporate media. News you can use every Tuesday for when they abuse and try to put the screws to use.
And now, here are headlines from Friday's Democracy Now!, WWW Indie, US Indie, New York City Indie, Madison Indie, Milwaukee Indie Media, DC Indie Media, Seattle Indie Media, etc., etc., etc. I will not be expounding on many of these, just because that's how I am today. Get them by Googling the keywords or something, huh? 21 killed in latest wave of Iraq violence. UN says 24,000 Iraqis died from war in a year. Suicide bombings on the rise in Iraq. CARICOM calls for Yvonne Neptune's release. Bolton moves to full Senate with no backing. Bush rode bike while Capitol White House evacuated. War resister Paredes gets 3 months hard labor. New charges against war resister Kevin Benderman. Connecticut carries out first execution in 45 years. And speaking of Connecticut, the Groton Navy base will be closing. Hoo-hoo-hoo! Yupper, they made the base closure list. No more getting off the short list by taking thousands of bus trips to D.C. lobbying in Connecticut. And is Joe Lieberman whining and whining? You betcha. So that's that. Bye-bye, Navy base. POG shuts down Military Recruitment Center in Oakland. 20th anniversary of MOVE bombing commemorated in Philadelphia. Workers and activists protest bad faith bargaining by Portland-based employer in California. The rugged Arizona desert dominated the media spotlight throughout April when hundreds of Minuteman Project volunteers organized to close a 23-mile stretch of the border with Mexico, with 24-hour monitoring and at times aiding U.S. Border Patrol by apprehending... Hey! That's a news report of United States paramilitary death squads, isn't it? Subtle difference, and there isn't much, let me tell you. Okay. Columbia anarchists killed by police in Columbia. Today the doctors announced the death of Nicholas David Nira Alvarez, a 15-year-old boy who was marching in the anarchist bloc the past 1st of May. Like never before in the past few years, many young people decided to come together to protest against capitalism. The huge demonstration, which included union workers, farmers, students, unemployed people, and activists, marched in a nonviolent manner on one of the main streets of Bogota. Bogota, I guess is how you pronounce that, huh? The demonstration not only remembered those who were killed by the state of Chicago, but also denounced the current precarious economical and social conditions of Colombia, demanded a halt to the free trade treaties, and made public the atrocities that are being committed by the current fascist government. Madison IMC's John Hamilton filed the following copy. Independent Congressman Bernie Sanders of Vermont spoke at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana on Tuesday, warning of the dangers of corporate control of the media in the United States. Sanders came to the Midwest as part of a conference entitled Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation? They spelled it wrong. Of Media Consolidation. If Sanders' speech is any indication, the answer to the question is a resounding no. Kathleen Beckett, also from Madtown IMC, got to interview Mordecai Vanunu while she and her husband were visiting East Jerusalem on March 30th, 2005. You can get the audio of that at Milwaukee IMC or at Madison IMC now. Wow, listen to that one for sure. Diane Farsetta writes in that Agnes Miller, better known as Grandma Agnes, won a 2005 Governor's Service Award for her volunteer work with young incarcerated men. May 22nd, the 5th annual Tour de Timor bike ride fundraiser will start at 1 p.m. at the corner of John Nolan Drive and Williamson Street between Machinery Row and Monona Terrace in Madison. As you might know, Madison is sister city to a town in East Timor for many years now. At DC IMC, you can get photos from the Tom DeLay Carnival of Corruption. And Class Warrior writes in that yesterday a Cessna pilot flying with bad maps accidentally caused a full-scale code red air assault alert for the White House and the Capitol. That must be when George Bush was riding his bike, right? And last but not least, from the Milwaukee Indy Wire, Pablo Paredes gets no jail, just a motion to E1 and 3 months of crap jobs for refusing to serve in Iraq. Right-wing goon hacker suspended from school, Clorox, also known as ELAC, also known as Brett Chance, got 2 years of college suspension for exploiting PHP bugs at multiple indie media sites running the Dada version of Active Open Publishing software. He's waiting to hear from the FBI about criminal prosecution, as his college alerted them as well. His family now knows everything that happened, and he says he won't be doing any black hat operations for a while. He's a huge fan of Kevin Mitnick, who's probably going to browbeat his ass heavily for becoming a right-wing reactionary idiot. At least that's my prediction. Wobbly Skip Porter reports, not only do the Wobs know how to put on a picket line, they sure know how to have a party. Time warp in Bayview at Puddler's Hall. St. Louis Indie Media reports that the Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression, known as CAPCR, in St. Louis, has been working to support the establishment of a civilian review board in the city of St. Louis. The proposed board would be formed as an independent civilian oversight mechanism that would primarily allow for neutral investigation of complaints against the police. Free Press, a media reform group, has recently descended on the city of St. Louis with its second national conference on media reform. Residents and activists in St. Louis have asked the conference to support the idea of a citizen oversight board to help diminish police brutality. David Rovix played Sing a Song for Chavez before the coup at Puddler's Hall, Milwaukee, May 5th. I think it was the 6th, actually. Sponsored by the Milwaukee Industrial Workers of the World. It's 5 minutes long. Snowshoe Films got the goods. See the movie at mke.indiemedia.org. Probably at snowshoefilms.org, too. Other AV, here is audio of Pablo Paredes on Democracy Now! This morning, reading the statement he gave in his court-martial. The judge, representing the government, went on to agree with him. And lastly, Cuban President Fidel Castro made clear this week he will not hand over political exile Assata Shakur, who has been living in Cuba since escaping from prison in 1979. U.S. officials put Shakur on a government terrorist watch list this month.
On location in St. Louis at the 2005 National Conference for Media Reform, this is Media Minutes, your review of news at the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson. Opening day of the conference was part celebration of accomplishments to date and part strategizing about how to build on those successes. Welcoming some 2,300 people to the conference, Free Press Executive Director Josh Silver says where 2 years ago there wasn't any real media reform movement to speak of, it cannot be denied now.
People said the media reform movement could never come together, that it was too fractured, that all the different groups and different interests could not communicate or collaborate. And I'm here to tell you that the victories that we've had, the growing momentum, the excitement that you feel when you look around this room, that you can feel in this room, has proven the skeptics wrong.
Janine Jackson, Program Director at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, says the time is past for celebration.
As we go forward, we need to keep asking ourselves, media reform for what? Do we want to break up dominant media conglomerations because it just sort of sounds better that there be like a smaller number of companies? No, it's not that. It's not an academic exercise. Media reform is not academic. Bad media hurts real people. Better media would help real people.
Others asked some tough questions about whether reform equals justice. Malkia Cyril, director of the San Francisco-based Youth Media Council, says there's three dominant myths prevalent within the media reform movement that must be shattered before real positive change takes place.
The first myth is that the U.S. media used to be more democratic and has become less so over time. The fact is, the U.S. media was born of colonial conquest and imperial intrusion, calling the democratic foundations of this press into direct question. For people of color, women, queer people, and young folks, there has never been a free press, and without racial, economic, and gender justice, there never will be. The second myth is that communication rights are inherently individual civil rights guaranteed by citizenship. What of the black, brown, female, queer, and young people whose basic civil rights require ongoing movements to secure, and even then are always in question? The third and final myth we must dismantle is that we can achieve a free press without also working to end racism, sexism, and class oppression. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Friday was divided into 9 panels and workshops covering the basics on media ownership and consolidation, corporate journalism, media policy, and activist tactics. Legendary musician Patti Smith lamented the creation of MTV.
It takes away music. The purity of music is something we hear and feel and interpret ourselves. It puts it in a box, interprets it basically sexually. Music TV exploits young people. It basically is teaching them to be consumers, to be self-involved.
And longtime producer Sandy Perlman, who has 15 platinum and gold records to his name for collaborations involving musicians ranging from The Clash to Blue Oyster Cult, says radio's gone down a similar path, a long way from what he considers its heydays.
From the late 60s through the late 70s, radio was a pretty insane place, which was actually interested in enlarging the number of inputs that went into the culture pool.
On the activism front, Nan Rubin, founder of New York-based Community Media Services, says she's concentrating on three goals, only the first of which is building new, independent media systems.
Strategy number one is own our own. Strategy number two is confronting the corporate media, monitoring and being watchdog groups, analyzing it, researching it, all the things in relationship to how the corporate media works. And then the third strategy is changing the rules. And that's when you get into some of the more conceptual things, things that are regulations, legislation, and in areas that are not even directly related to what we might be familiar with, like not necessarily just the FCC, but there's a whole lot of activity going on in technology and what's happening with how the technology is being used and rules that are getting created for how the technology will or won't be used.
The panels and workshops continue through Saturday with a keynote event closing out the conference's second full day. Speakers there will include Jim Hightower, FCC Commissioners Jonathan Adelstein and Michael Copps, Al Franken, and many more. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
I'm DJ Microbrew, and I'm telling you, the revolution is brewing in small batches.
This is Bad Cop, No Donut for the week of May 12th, 2005.
All right, police!
Bad Cop, No Donut!
Bad.
Cop.
No. Donut.
It's under law, and I rule.
With your weekly wrap-up of North American police brutality, misconduct, and corruption, I'm Ron Anisich at CKLN in Toronto.
Editor's note, I'm clipping out everything except the Milwaukee, Madison, and Oshkoshish stuff. Thank you.
A Milwaukee, Wisconsin police officer who appealed his October termination was disappointed to learn this week that the decision to fire him was upheld. A report in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel says that Officer Andrew Gebhardt was accused of tobogganing, bowling, making a prank phone call to 911, and visiting an illegal after-hours bar, all acts he is alleged to have committed while on the job. In October, he became one of the 11 police officers to be fired by the new Milwaukee chief, who has only been on the job for just over 1 year. Gebhardt appealed his termination, arguing at one point that unlike the other fired Milwaukee officers, he had not been accused of beating or raping anyone. But this week, the Police and Fire Commission upheld that decision. Speaking of which, another Milwaukee police officer was fired this week for refusing to answer questions related to the brutal October beating of a visible minority man by a gang of more than a dozen white police officers at a party at the home of one of the officers. According to an Associated Press report, Officer John Clausing was fired last Thursday for refusing to obey a command from a superior officer. He is also facing internal charges of breaking state law, lying, and failing to report information to the department about the beating incident. He was one of 13 officers facing a total of 79 department charges in connection with the beating. Discipline for the other officers has not been decided yet. Clausing is also currently under investigation for using excessive force against a woman on March 3rd while he was on duty. A third Milwaukee police officer was fired this week for reasons that have not yet been made public. A man is suing the Milwaukee Police Department and the city after being beaten by Milwaukee police last July. WISN reports that the man, a soldier on leave from duty in Iraq, was beaten by police while he was handcuffed. A press conference was held by the man's family and lawyers last Thursday. Milwaukee police are not commenting on the lawsuit. A report in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported this week that taxpayers in that city have paid nearly $500,000 in wages over the past 16 months to police officers who were or remain suspended with pay or fired. A Wisconsin state law, which applies only to the Milwaukee Police Department, says that officers who are fired by the department are to be paid until their appeals process has been exhausted. A police officer in Appleton, Wisconsin, pleaded guilty last Friday to sexually assaulting two young boys. The Associated Press says that Officer Gerald Polzin was originally facing 22 charges, but pleaded guilty to 6 in a deal to have the remaining charges dropped. Polzin was accused of sexually assaulting two young boys, aged 15 and 16, one of whom was a student at the school where the officer worked. He was reported to police by his brother, who viewed a videotape which was part of a box of items which the officer had asked his brother to destroy. The videotape, which will be seen by the jury, which will be making a decision regarding sentencing, depicted sex acts which took place between the officer and one of his two victims. He will be sentenced on July 12th on 5 counts of second-degree sexual assault and 1 count of sexual exploitation of a child. Polzin faces 212 years in prison if convicted on his charges. That's all for this week's show. Tune into this station next week for more. Email your comments and story ideas to ron@ckln.fm. Thanks to everyone who sent in articles for this week's show. From CKLN 88.1 FM in Toronto, I'm Ron Anisich. Each week, we end Bad Cop No Donut with a song. This week, it's Till the Pigs Come Round by the Subhumans.
Shall live in peace and unafraid. And everyone beneath their vine and fig tree shall live in peace and not afraid. And into plowshares beat their swords. Nations shall learn war no more. And into plowshares beat their swords. Nations shall learn war no more, and everyone beneath their vine and fig tree shall be in peace and not afraid. And everyone beneath their vine and fig tree shall live in peace and not afraid. And into plowshares beat their swords. Nations shall learn war no more. And into plowshares beat their swords. Nations shall learn war no more. And everyone beneath their vine and fig tree shall live in peace and not afraid. And everyone beneath their vine and fig tree shall live in peace and not afraid.
Next up is a one-minute memo from the Virgin Phone.
02134. Here's a shout-out to Christopher Leiden, I'm listening to his podcast while I make photocopies in the office to the homeless shelter that I help run. Work on his Zoom. Later.
Getting email complaints that I don't voice in what technology I'm using. Gads, that's boring, but all right, just this once, and I'm not going to use too much bandwidth every week retelling this. So that's that. I start most of my scripts on a Tungsten E Palm Pilot, but note that I also use TextPad and Notepad inside of Windows 2000 and OpenOffice in SUSE 9.2. I'm on two 400 megahertz boxes. One's an HP, remaining fairly stock, and the other's a Dell, overclocked to 670 or so. Now for recording. I'm teaching myself Audacity, but in the meantime, I'm doing Waves with SoundForge. My MPs and Ogg Vorbises are coming to you through Cool Edit 1.2. That's long before the Photoshop buyout. The microphone, let me look at it real quick. It's a Labtec AM242, probably sold for $29.95 brand new. I think I bought it in a pawn shop for about $7. Thank you. Let's try this, see how it goes. I'm DJ Microbrew, and I'm going to voice in a story written by Ken Commando for CBS News. It's called What Your iPod Reveals About You. Got an iPod? Be careful who finds out what's stored in it. Some researchers think that the music you listen to can tell more about you than you might think. What, if anything, can we determine about people based on the music they buy and keep on an iPod? It's an interesting question for serious researchers. A story in the Washington Post cited research from Georgia Tech in Atlanta. The research measured what people think of others based only on the songs in their iPod. And just a few weeks ago, of course, we learned from the news what's in Mr. Bush's iPod, the POTUS Bush. They say that what's in your iPod may become a new way for people to size you up as a potential mate or political candidate. The point? I don't really know just how much musical taste can reveal about anyone, but I do know that if enough people think they can read things into what I listen to, then I'm going to be very careful about who gets a peek into my iPod library. Hear that, Mr. President?
You are listening to Radioactive San Diego, creating positive...
Oops, cut him off. Maybe positive vibes or something? Let's see. Out of my email box, I should look up John Ross's Mexico Barbero, because I really want to read you a little bit of that. Huh, where is it? Still looking. Ah, Blind Man's Buff, number 70, from John Ross. The Chavo spectacle featured withering hatred between loved ones, demagoguery run riot, and crazed Catholic zealots, born-agains and not-dead-yets, wholly rolling around on the Florida hospice's manicured front lawn. The 24/7 media circus was ringmastered by that indefatigable exterminator Tom DeLay of Sugarland, Texas, who parlayed the hysteria into an unprecedented congressional vote that put the legislative branch on a train wreck course with the Constitution. Right? Ratzinger's selection settled over the world like a pall. Those who had anticipated a pope of color, Latin America accounts for half the Roman Catholics in this part of the galaxy, had foolishly underestimated the racism entombed in the bosom of Holy Mother Church. As dispensation to the disillusion, Chilean Cardinal Jorge Arturo Agustin Medina Estevez was pushed out on the balcony to sound the time-honored cry, "We have a pope." By the way, you should know that Cardinal Medina is or was Augusto Pinochet's favorite priest. Benedictus XVI had operated as Wotla's ventriloquist since 1981, when he took over the congregation for the defense of the doctrine of the faith, formerly known as the Santa Inquisition, and began to dismantle Vatican II, the historic accord hammered out by the People's Pope, John 23, that insisted upon the Church's option for the poor. Ratzinger's promotion to the throne of Peter and the installation of Paul Wolfowitz at the World Bank are indeed ominous tidings for the world's poor. .. I'm not going to read you this entire screed because it's huge. This is John Ross's living will, and I'll end with this. And then I'll find you links to some of his other writings, because he's phenomenal, right? John Ross? You don't know John Ross? You should. When I, John Ross, become so debilitated by terminal illness that the consumption of opiate-derived drugs no longer quells the pain, and or when I am rendered helpless by disease, intentional violence, or a freak accident, I ask that a guardian be appointed who will strap dynamite to my cadaver, wheel me to the designated capitalist target, and light the fuse. The burning of my body, Bonza style, would be an acceptable alternative to such sabotage, but only if I am propped up in front of a recognizable emblem of U.S. imperialist domination while I roast. Say no to war and world hunger, racism, sexism, class, capitalism, and all other isms that get in the way of the people's struggle to control their own destinies. There is no peace without justice. Hasta la victoria siempre. Bye-bye. John Ross is a 2005 recipient of the Upton Sinclair Uppy Award, presented by the Southern California chapter of the ACLU, for his latest instant cult classic, Murdered by Capitalism, a memoir of 150 years of life and death on the U.S. left. The Blind Man is off on a reporting speaking tour of the U.K., Spain, Amsterdam, Turkey, and perhaps points east, tracking stories of class and race war, the genocide of farmers, and global resistance to the corporate globalization of the planet, and will be reporting from the Istanbul final session of the Iraqi War Crimes Tribunal. Contributions to ease the pain of travel can be sent to John Ross in his name at 3258 23rd Street, Apartment 3, San Francisco, California, 94110. And that's that.
Hello, and welcome to DJ Microbrew's fourth promo, May 4th, for File System Check, the corporate media. Philip Lafayette Gibbs. James Earl Green. The revolution is brewing in small batches. Dial www.thepentagon.com/podcasting. Please, please listen to my weekly podcast. Dial 1-800-thepentagon.com/podcasting. File system check the corporate media.
Thing on.
10 days later, on May 14, 1970, two students at Jackson State University in Mississippi were shot dead. 21-year-old Philip Lafayette Gibbs and a high school student named James Earl Green.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen.
Those words were spoken by an electronic computer. They are an example of synthetic speech, a product of Bell Telephone Laboratories' research into the basic nature of speech. Knowledge developed through such research may be useful in devising new techniques for transmitting speech over communication systems. To make the computer talk, it is fed punched cards containing the names of speech sounds. The computer combines these sounds, in accordance with the linguistic rules which govern the English language, into connected, intelligible speech. For example, when the sounds for the sentence, "He saw the cat," are fed into the computer in sequence, it says,
"He saw the cat."
The flat, monotonous tones of the computer indicate an absence of the pitch and timing characteristics natural to human speech. When timing information is added to the punch cards, the computer says,
"He saw the cat."
The sentence still sounds unnatural. 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 But when pitch information also is added to the cards,
"He saw the cat,"
the computer speaks in accents almost completely human, except for a slight electronic twang. In the following sentence, most of the variables inherent in human speech have been specified on the punch cards. The computer makes one of the pivotal remarks in the development of the telephone.
"Mr. Watson, come here. I want you."
The present quality of speech synthesis by computer is illustrated in the next example, part of a famous soliloquy from Hamlet.
"To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep."
Singing, in purely physical terms, is essentially a matter of pitch and timing. In the next selection, the computer sings a familiar ditty.
Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer to. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage. But you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
The computer now sings the same tune, but to a musical accompaniment played by another computer. Piano students will notice that the music-producing computer has a rather stylized left hand. Incidentally, synthesizing music on a computer is almost as formidable as making a computer talk.
Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer to. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage. But you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
To get the samples of synthesized speech we've heard so far, a computer's memory was stored with 34 speech sounds and a set of rules for producing these sounds and for making the transitions from one sound to another. When the computer was fed the names of speech sounds on punch cards, it was, in effect, told what to say. But its manner of saying it, even its dialect and apparent accent, was determined by the rules stored in its memory. The objective of this program is to formulate a minimum set of rules for making plausible English speech. The next two selections, however, were produced by analyzing a person's speech and reconstructing it synthetically on a computer. The objective here is to duplicate the sounds and transitions made by a human speaker, including his dialect and accent. With such a program, the computer sounds like this.
Men strive but seldom get rich. Now if you don't mind, I'd like to say a few words about Texas.
And now the computer would like to express its appreciation for your attention.
Thanks for listening.